Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Atheists, agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
The government, hug the government, love. The government, hug the government, love. The government, hug the government, love.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, a professor of political science at Northern Kentucky University. I'm joined today by my conservative counterpart, Cleveland area attorney Jay Carson.
Good morning, Mike.
Hey, Jay, how you doing?
Well, I'm feeling like there was a headline that read. I can't claim this for myself, but it's the morning after in America.
There you go. Yeah, I am feeling as if a certain weight has lifted. We will be talking about that. I am sure. But before we do get to our many topics of discussion for today, we want to thank our newest Patreon supporters, Jonathan, David, Andrew, Sherna, Keenan, Lee, Jody Marie, Woody, Emily, Matthew, Patrick, and Derek, as well as Joshua, Maggie, Sydney, and Josh, who increased their Patreon support for us. We really appreciate that. As well as some new PayPal supporters, Edwin, and a very generous contribution from Kelly. Thank you all. It means an awful lot to us. These are incredibly challenging times, certainly, and your support really helps us sort of keep on top of things and do what we do. Derek, I want to mention, wrote in to say thank you for all the hard work you put into the show each and every week. It's a breath of fresh air to hear civilized debate in a time of great division. Each and every podcast makes an hour and a half commute go by in a snap. That's nice to hear that we are making your commute a little bit better. And of course, if you want to be a Patreon supporter, you get not only that second full-length episode every week, you also get ad-free versions of all of our shows, as well as other things at different levels of support. To check it all out, just go to patreon.com/politicsguys. And if you'd like our weekly bonus show, but you can't afford to support the show financially right now, totally not a problem. Just send me an email, mike@politicsguys.com, and I will make that happen. And of course, we also have our PayPal support option. And to find out more about that, there's not much more to find out about, but there is a link, politicsguys.com/support. And one thing, as always, that helps us out enormously and that is absolutely free that we really appreciate is spreading the word by sharing episodes on social media. It only takes a few seconds, and it is absolutely the best sort of advertising. All right, so with that, we'll start this week in about the place you'd expect us to start, with the peaceful transfer of power. On Wednesday, January 20th, Joe Biden became the 46th president of the United States, and it was an inauguration day unlike, well, any other, certainly in our memory, with the country, you know, ravaged by the pandemic, 2 weeks after an attempted insurrection on the grounds of the very Capitol where President Biden was sworn in. And it was also, of course, the first inauguration not attended by the outgoing president in 152 years. So, Jay, what did you think about, let's start with the inauguration ceremonies and then, you know, maybe move into President Biden's inaugural address.
So, you know, I would say, and this is me speaking as a conservative Republican, I think for the most part, he hit all the right tones in the ceremony. And truth be told, I didn't watch the whole ceremony just because I don't, when I got a day job. I think it was generally well done, well put together. I think the nod to the lives lost in from COVID was appropriate. I think in some ways, I mean, this allowed sort of a better, easier, less spectacular, if you will, inauguration, just because you know, the crowd size was going to be limited. The security was going to be limited, both because of COVID concerns and security concerns. So generally, I you know, if we're looking at the overall production value of the show, I think it was good. On the speech itself, I posted in our Discord group, I think, really pretty quickly after. I thought was very good. I think, again, he hit all the right notes. And he the delivery, I think, was good also. I mean, there has been a, you know, lingering concern of does Joe Biden still have it? My sense is that, he delivered on this speech. I mean, you can, if you want to get into the particulars, or if you want to give your overall view before we hit particulars, we can do that.
Sure.
Shoot with your overall.
Yeah, well, I
you liked it.
I absolutely liked it. I think certainly it's a marked contrast to President Trump's inaugural address, the American Carnage address, after which former President George W. Bush was reported to have said that was some weird shit. This was pretty normal, right? And I think the main, you know, the theme of this one, democracy has prevailed, and the main policy themes in there were things that I would have expected. You know, first and foremost, as you mentioned, the focus on the pandemic, racial justice, climate change, and white nationalism. And those were, you know, things that I would have expected President Biden to hit, and he did. And there were, you know, many, many calls for unity, calls to respect the truth. And, I'm for all of that stuff. So, yeah, I felt it was a great address.
Not the white supremacists.
What's that? Thank you. Yes.
Just to be clear
on that. Yes. So, I mean, I don't think it's going to make any sort of a difference. The idea of that we have presidential honeymoons anymore, I think, has gone by the wayside, certainly. But it was the sort of address that I would have expected, and that's exactly what we, you know, exactly what we got.
I would say one of the reasons I liked it actually was maybe this is maybe one of the reasons that you seem to like it more. My sense was there was not a ton of policy stuff in there, which I think was appropriate because look, in an inaugural, it's not a State of the Union, right? It's not here's this program, here's that program. It's broader themes, and it is more aspirational of what we can do as a people and unity. And I really think the unity message was particularly important. Now, I mean, more than ever, this is that to me, if you want to take out all the other actual issues before our country, that's the big one, right? And I think he hit the right notes on that. Something else that struck me was the frequent mentions of God and prayer, which more so than you've seen in any past inaugural that I can remember, even going back to, say, Ronald Reagan. And this struck me, and I think this would be reassuring to a lot of conservatives who see sort of the left as a, if not anti-religious, then at least sort of scoffing. And, you know, there was it reassured a lot of Americans that Biden did not view them as someone who's bitterly clinging to their religion. And I do think that's really important in sort of national healing. And I think it's important and in a bigger, is more philosophical way. And so I'm on the one hand, I'll say, look, it's good politics. But I think there's also something that to be said of everything we've been through in the last year, and regardless of one's religious beliefs or lack of religious beliefs, I think there's a lesson in humility, that there's only so much anyone can do. There's only, there are a lot of big problems that can't be solved by legislation or executive order, or prevented by legislation or executive order. And in acknowledging some higher power, there's sort of some humility to that, right? That it's some things are out of our hands, and we just seek the ability to do the best we can where we are. So I liked all that part of it. The start afresh. Again, that was a welcome statement, right? That it's not about seeking revenge and so forth. Now we'll get into this later, but it troubles me a little bit that one of the first places he wanted to start afresh was at the NLRB General Counsel's office. But that's a different sort of piece. So, but generally, I'd give him an A.
All right. Wow. Well, you know, I'm heartened to hear that. Certainly.
I have some issues coming up with what he actually did.
Sure.
Immediately after that.
And that is my takeaway from, well, I think a call for unity does not mean a call to just sort of, you know, give in to what the other side's policy preferences are, certainly. And that's why I think, I think it's good that, you know, you felt that this was a good address and, kind of return to sort of a normalcy, that sort of thing. But also, I think from a practical standpoint, it doesn't necessarily have much of an effect. And that's too bad. You know, President Biden said, you know, to listen to him, to hear him out, to look into his heart or something like that. And I just don't think that, unfortunately, really happens. There aren't too many people who are undecided at this point who are willing to give the president the benefit of the doubt, whether that would have been President Trump or President Biden, because that's the America we live in now, and that's unfortunate. But
I would disagree. I think there are people out there. Look, I mean, I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt, you know, as you said, look, I mean, inauguration speeches are aspirational, and they are, you know, to some extent, soft and fuzzy. It's not hard policy stuff.
Sure.
So, you know, it depends on what happens next as to whether we view this speech as, hey, this was a really moment of unity, or it was just a, you know, saying the right things.
Yeah.
I will say something that, you know, for to jump ahead a little bit, and this will probably erase all the good points I just earned with our liberal listeners. You know, what struck me was, as he is speaking about you know, God and starting afresh and all this, and speaking these really great words of unity and we're not enemies, and you know, at that same moment, the letters are being delivered to the NLRB, to the place, and saying, "Get out of here by 2 o'clock, or you're fired."
Almost like you don't want the NLRB general counsel to be someone who's aggressively anti-labor. How strange!
I get that. But again, this is someone who is. This is the first time in 47 years this has ever happened. And say what you will about Donald Trump, but he didn't do that. This is someone who still had 10 months to serve. He had been confirmed by the Senate. But no, the image I sort of played in my head, it's sort of like Michael Corleone at the baptism, right? I mean, he's, you know, do you reject Satan and all his works? And then it cuts to, you know, the...
So are you saying what President Biden did was unconstitutional or exceeded his authority?
It may have exceeded his authority in as to the NLRB council. I think there's a good question on that. I don't think it exceeded his authority as to the CFPB appointment. I think he does have authority to.
Well, the Supreme Court has said as much. Yeah. So.
Yeah. I think it's a little bit of a different situation where you have someone who has Senate confirmation and has been confirmed for a certain term. I would agree. Look, and I've said this before in the Trump administration, and I'll say it again now, that I think a president certainly has the right and really the obligation to put in his own team. Right. That's if we're going to have representative democracy, that's how it works. And the executive needs to be able to have his own policy people in these key places. That said, where there are limitations, then, you know, those still have to be respected. And I, again, to me, it's maybe the timing is a little bit, you know, that this is the the first day, you know, literally as he's being sworn in, priority, that strikes me as being perhaps inconsistent with hearing everyone out and the unity that we talked about.
Well, again, I think unity and hearing everyone out, there's a record of behavior, and under Donald Trump, the NLRB basically was as eager as it could possibly be to roll over to business and ensure that, you know, labor relations meant capitulating to the interests of business, and that's, you know, that's I would say what the Republican Party believes, not because they hate workers, but just because they tend to see unions and organizing as a bad thing that hurts almost everyone, whereas we on the left see unions and organizing as an incredibly important force for,
sure.
You know, and so in that sense, I don't see, it's certainly not putting a hit out on anyone. It's just saying, hey, you know, we're going to take care of labor because we believe in that. And we're not going to have somebody, a general counsel at the NLRB, who is anti-labor. And if he wants to challenge that removal, I don't think he actually is doing so, you know.
Well, he hasn't yet.
Yeah.
It remains to be seen.
Yeah, it is a gray area whether or not he can be removed. I think at this point, there's certainly not a clear statutory authority to do that sort of thing.
No, I'd agree on that, but I'm just saying, yeah. Again, in contrast to the message of, And let's set a couple things apart. The NLRB is a sort of semi-autonomous organization, right? And it has a number of commissioners who are appointed by various presidents and approved by Congress over the years. It's like the Federal Reserve, right? It's semi-autonomous. So it's the general counsel doesn't set policy. For the NLRB, he's an employee,
right?
So I think that's a distinction worth making, and you know, the NLRB makeup has to do with folks who had been appointed over the years. There was a dust up during the Obama administration where he appointed or tried to appoint some extra commissioners while the, as he said, the Senate was in recess. The problem was the Senate was not in recess. So I'm just saying, if I'm a conservative out there and I listen to the speech and say, let's start afresh and we're going to have unity and we're going to work together and we're not enemies, and then 15 minutes later, it's, you know, the guy gets the note saying clear out your desk in an hour and a half or you're fired. Those messages seem to be one could be. You can understand why some might see some inconsistency in that message.
Sure.
As opposed to the more typical message of listen. Well, for one thing, this guy had a term, right? This is a term that goes through another 10 months.
Well, let's be clear on that. This is the gray area here because there's Supreme Court precedent suggesting that a statutorily, I can say the word, it's early for me, fixed term is a limit on that person's length of service, but not necessarily a limit on the president's authority to remove that person. In fact, even John Roberts, back when he was White House counsel or an associate counsel, said that in his view, the president had every right to remove the general counsel of the NLRB because that person served at the pleasure of the president. And so I think
that's a live argument.
Yeah, exactly. But I hear, you know, not to get us too off track.
I'm not arguing what you're saying. I'm not arguing the legal point here.
Yeah.
I'm arguing the optics.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. And
right?
I think the optics are only going to matter. I mean, this is not a high profile sort of thing, right?
No.
The only people who actually would even,
which to me makes it all the more telling. But go ahead.
Well, I'm saying the only people who would even know about this sort of thing are the people who are already pretty, I think, high information people who already have their minds more or less, you know, made up. I mean, let's recall, I mean, you said you're willing to give Joe Biden the benefit of the doubt, but I don't really think that means anything. And the reason why is because just, you know, a couple of months ago, you essentially said that Joe Biden was the road to socialism. I mean, more or less. And so giving, so I don't know.
The NLRB thing has raised my concerns. You know, I mean, I'm not, that may well be the case.
Yeah.
So I'm saying give them the benefit of the doubt, but.
Can you, maybe if it would help if you could explain to me what that means to you in practice by saying giving somebody the benefit of the doubt. Maybe I'm just misunderstanding.
So I would say to me that means I am going to start with the assumption that he intends to act not in a purely partisan manner, but act for the best interests of the country as he sees it. And in doing so, I mean, consistent with his speech, you can have political adversaries, but they're not necessarily your enemies. It is not a matter of denigrating or destroying your opponents. It's a matter of policy difference. And just on this little NLRB example, I think you can, you know, a way that could have been handled, you could have sent a letter saying, listen, I'm the new president. I don't think our views are consistent. I'd ask that, you know, I'd like to have my own counsel installed there. Here is the precedent on which I would be relying in doing so. I'd appreciate it if you could give your 2 weeks notice so I can start moving forward with this. That's a different kind of message than get out within an hour or you're fired.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah, sure. I see what you're saying.
So, I mean, I think that's what I'm saying is I fully respect the president's ability to pick his own people. And like I said, I think that's an important part of democracy.
That's not unreasonable. I see what you're saying, because it was a very quick ultimatum saying, yeah, if you don't quit today, you'll be fired. So sure. A gesture could have been made to say, hey, you know, take a few weeks, that sort of thing. And it's not like, as you pointed out, it's the general counsel. It's not a policy position per se. So yeah, I think you're right on that. And I won't say I retract my, I don't know if I was exactly being pugnacious, but yeah, I think you're right on that. I think you're right.
I'm the same way with the CFPB, right? And I, again, I it's just a matter of if we are going to, you know, to quote Lincoln, right, that we move forward with malice toward none and charity for all.
Well,
do I say that right, or do I say that? Is it the other way around?
That's right. But the CFPB thing's a little bit different, because that, I mean, there's a pretty clear statutory,
yeah, no,
and
no,
it's
no,
also
I,
a policymaking position.
I absolutely agree with the statutory, because this is something that Trump fought, right? I mean, the issue last time was the head of the CFPB, Richard Cordray, stepped down, and Trump tried to appoint someone. The CFPB said, no, we're going to appoint our own person. Which is, if you think about it, really kind of ludicrous. But
well, not ludicrous. I'm going to push back on that. Not ludicrous, because it was an open question given how the legislation, how the enabling
right.
Legislation for the CFPB was written, and the court actually, you know, concluded that there was a defect in that language. And so, but saying that it's ludicrous, I think, would be going too far.
Let me back up then. How about, instead of ludicrous, let me say inconsistent with the principles that I just set forth about that in our government, you know, throughout these various agencies, there ought to be some sort of political accountability eventually, whether that's with, you know, Congress who appoints or dismisses, or a president who appoints. That an agency can't just run its own show independent of Congress or the presidency. But again, my point isn't to whether he has the power or not to do it, because I think he absolutely does. But if you're going to handle it, the manner in which it's being handled. And in this case, the head of the CFPB did, step aside and said, yeah, absolutely. Joe, go ahead and appoint your own person. So.
Sure. You know, one other thing I wanted to mention is something that didn't happen. There was a lot of word that or concern that there would be these big protests at state capitals, which were seen as much sort of softer targets in a way, not protected by the massive show of force at the nation's capital. And yet that fizzled about as badly as any of those things. There were some instances where I think in Sacramento and Albany, there was like one guy who was there with a sign. And
Right. And
I'm wondering, I mean, it was sort of a happily, you could be happy at how pitiful that was. But it also, some people might say, well, what does that mean about white nationalist extremism? Is it, is it as big of a deal? Do we need to worry about this sort of domestic terrorism? And I wanted to get your take on that because, of course, our state capital here, Columbus, was one of those places that there was thought to be the threat of some sort of real action. And like in pretty much everywhere else, it just didn't happen.
Yeah.
What do you make of that?
Yeah. Goofballs show up.
Yeah.
So, I mean, look, this is kind of where I've always been on this whole big, alt-right white supremacy question is, there just aren't that many of them out there. And I really think, this goes back way, way back, when you and I went to protest the Klan in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And this was 25 years ago now.
Yeah.
30 years ago now.
Oh, right? God, let's not even think about how many years ago it was. But yeah,
but there was,
a long time
there was
ago.
This, the idea that the Klan is watching. Mike and I were both students living in Washington at the time. And damn it, we're going to go down there and tell these guys they weren't welcome. And also part of it was we were young and we're just there for the spectacle. And it all turns out, I mean, there were I don't know, thousands, tens of thousands of protesters, anti-Klan protesters. And maybe about a half dozen Klansmen actually showed up. We never actually saw any actual Klansmen. The same thing has happened in other those kind of marches, protests, and there were some in Columbus back when I worked there. And the typical result was you got just literally a handful of these folks who are going to out and show up. Charlottesville, which was the big Unite the Right, big piece of this. If you go back and look at the actual numbers, when you look at big mass movements and mass marches, they aren't that big. I mean, it's not to say this is insignificant, right? If you have, 1,000 people who are angry, violent white supremacists, that's 1,000 too many, in any given place. But it's not, for example, the films that you see from like the 1920s of the Klan marching on Washington, of tens of thousands of these folks. The same goes for the insurrection of 2 weeks ago. There were certainly people among that crowd and among the people smashing into the Capitol who were white supremacists. There were also a whole bunch who were just crazy QAnon believers. There were a bunch of, I think, folks who are just nuts. There were some who were angry over any number of issues. And the left has this instinct to paint everything and as it's a white supremacy play. This is racism, and for a number of reasons. One is it sells politically, but I don't think that's the case. And I think sometimes, particularly as we're looking at Trump voters, that's been a weakness, right? I mean, it's sort of the Hillary deplorable sort of thing. If you just write off all these people as, oh, they're just crazy white supremacists, I think you're really missing something. And I think the actual number of real white supremacists out there are fairly few and far between. Again, that's not to say that number is zero, or that it's acceptable in any way, shape or form. But I don't, there was such this idea of this is a white takeover, a push kind of thing, and I just don't think that jives with the facts.
Well, I hear what you're saying, and I think it is important not to lump everyone under one label. But I also think that, point out, some of the people who are the most extreme and the most dangerous, even if there are a handful of them, that's a handful too many. And, We saw what happened in Michigan before this and the Capitol there and the plot to kidnap and do harm to the Michigan's governor and this. And so, even, of course, in the Trump administration's own Homeland Security Department said that white extremism, white nationalism is the greatest domestic threat to the homeland. And it's clear that President Biden and the Biden administration is taking that very seriously, not just rhetorically in the inaugural address, but also in orders to really, ramp up investigations of this sort of thing, because it is, even though I agree with you, it's certainly a very tiny number of people given the size of the country, but they can certainly do an awful lot of damage. And I think it's good that we're going to see a serious focus on that.
Right. And I would compare it, and I'll do this. I mean, let's look at Islamic fundamentalism terrorists, right? And to say that there are Islamic fundamentalist terrorists in this country, yes, that's absolutely true. Is there a large growing movement of them? No, it's people here and there. It's small cells. Those are absolutely dangerous, and they need to be investigated and shut down. And the same goes for white supremacist domestic terrorists. I guess you can draw a line between people who are truly criminals and in criminal intent, versus a lot of folks who are just kind of angry and disaffected.
I agree. So it sounds like we're more or less on the same page on this, I would say.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, on that, let's just take a quick break, and then we will be right back and talk about Joe Biden's, not his words, but his executive actions. So as expected, the Biden administration began with a bunch of executive actions, and they focused on a lot of things, pandemic response, immigration and border security, climate, LGBTQ rights, the standard freeze of all pending regulations by the previous administration. And I thought the place we could start is the main focus of executive action so far, and that's pandemic response. There were a bunch of orders in this area from President Biden. They included things like masks on all federal property, federal workers and contractors, masks at airports, expanding testing, increasing treatment access, data collection, guidance on reopening and keeping workers safe, using the Defense Production Act to fill supply shortfalls, bringing the U.S. back in the World Health Organization, creating a national COVID response coordinator, extending those eviction and foreclosure moratoriums, extending the federal student loan repayment pause, increasing food aid, and that commitment to 100 million shots in 100 days, which looks to be pretty much on track at this point. There's a lot there, Jay. So let's just start with your general reaction to the COVID-related executive orders.
Well, I would say, as you might expect, some of those I like better than others.
Sure.
Some of them I think are really sort of symbolic as opposed to accomplishing anything. My sense is that most federal buildings, most federal property, people were already required to wear masks, just by the building order, by the state order, by but as if you got an executive order, that sends a message too. Although there was a really fun exchange with Press Secretary Jen Psaki later in the week regarding that. Things like the eviction moratorium, I didn't like it when Trump did it, and I'm not crazy about it now, just because I don't know that that's within the power of the president to unilaterally suspend contracts for people across the country nationwide. I'm not arguing that it's bad policy. Mm-hmm. But my point is, I don't know that that's something that a president can do by a stroke of a pen.
That's being done under public health, under public health emergency powers.
Right. Which again, to me seems kind of I think it's a stretch, and I don't think it'll really be challenged.
Right.
But nonetheless, look, if you're somebody like me who thinks a lot about what can the government do and what can it do, I think it's an important question. That said, I would agree that state governments could certainly do that. State courts could do that, but that's another issue. On the, you know, a million shots in so many days, that strikes me as one of those sort of aspirational orders of, okay, well, I'll you know, the president can't just order things into reality. He can set goals, and hopefully that happens. If it doesn't, I'm not sure what the consequences would be.
And he's getting some pushback for making that goal not ambitious enough, because right now it seems like, well, yeah, we're pretty much on track for that. So why not increase it?
If you get the million shots,
There you go. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And say, look, I did it. I said I wanted a million shots. Sign the order. Million shots.
Yeah.
And again, to me, that, you know, so I look at those things as I don't think there was ever any sense of, you know, let's slow down the shots beforehand. So,
no.
So regardless, on some of the other issues, I don't have a big, you know, there's no real objection to be had. A lot of it's stuff that was being done already. So on the COVID front, I don't have a lot to complain about or argue about, other than what I just pointed out with the rental thing. I think some of this is outside of the health power of the president. But
To me, this is what a real national response looks like. And it would have been great to see something like this, you know, 8, 10, 11 months ago. And so better late than never, I suppose, certainly. And it's pretty clear that Joe Biden and the Biden administration treat this with all the seriousness that it deserves to be treated with. And that's, of course, in marked contrast to, you know, the previous administration, at least at the very top, where, you know, the president was, well, he was who he was on that issue. And so, you know, you had Dr. Fauci a few days ago saying it's kind of nice to, you know, be able to say what I think the science says, as opposed to feeling like I'm being, you know, squelched and that sort of thing. And so I certainly applaud this. And I think this is particularly important, given that it seems very likely that we're going to hit, you know, 500,000 deaths from COVID within the next month or so. We've already surpassed that 400,000. And to me, this goes, and we'll talk about this, if not on this show, on the bonus show, about the Trump record. And for all the good that some people may argue he's done in some areas, I wouldn't be one of those people. But I know some people can make a not, you know, unreasonable argument about that. I would say, when you look at the COVID response in the United States compared to other rich developed countries, it's grim. It really is. In deaths per capita, we're the 11th worst in the world, right there between North Macedonia and Bulgaria. Fifth worst of the 37 OECD countries. Compare us to, say, Canada, which is 52nd worst. That's more where you'd want to be. And cases per capita were really bad. So, and you know, not all of that is part of that is.
Some things go to things like population density and so forth, though, too. I mean, you're comparing
absolutely.
Us with, say, Canada.
Absolutely. But I don't think there's anyone who would realistically look at the response by the Trump administration and say, job well done, fellas, you know, folks. And so I'm really happy that the Biden administration is doing what they're doing. And I think it's going to matter. I think it's going to save lives.
All right. But I mean, something else I didn't mention a second ago were other things that you had mentioned about guidance to schools and so forth. Mm-hmm. That again, I would put that in the category of I'm not. It's a little troubling in terms of I think there's a very good argument that kids should be back in school as soon as possible. Given the relatively low risk of transmission and serious consequences to kids versus the high risk of being out of school, both educationally, socially, and for a lot of those students who depend on schools for a variety of other services and are not well equipped at home to learn at home.
And so President Biden agrees with you.
And that's
you know, part of the push there also is that push toward increased testing certainly is going to help. And so I think everyone, just about everyone, agrees on the importance of opening schools and having schools for in-person learning as soon as is possibly
there would be some teachers unions that would disagree with you quite vociferously on that.
But I don't think they disagree on that. I think they would disagree on what constitutes a safe environment.
All right, fair enough.
So yeah. But why don't we move on then? Because it seems like you have some sort of niggles on this and you know, issues about state power. But for the most part, you looked at the president's actions on COVID and you're like, okay. Right?
Yeah. I'd say that's a good summary. Yes.
All right. So let's move on to immigration, and the president's actions on immigration include rescinding the border wall emergency, halting new construction, preserving and fortifying DACA. We'll talk about that, I'm sure. Ordering that all residents of the United States, regardless of citizenship status, be counted by the census, which, you know, is what has been done in the past. But anyway, let's see what else. Ending discriminatory travel bans on entry to the United States, and this is a big one here.
But creating other travel bans.
Well, we'll get to that. Introducing legislation that provides enhanced border security and infrastructure in line with, and here's the big part, legal status and a path to citizenship for the 10.5 million or so undocumented immigrants currently living in the United States. So I get the sense, I'm betting, Jay, that there are going to be some things we're going to disagree on a little bit more here. So what's your take on the president's—
Would I disagree with some of these from a policy perspective? Yes.
Sure.
But the executive order giveth and the executive order taketh away. At least that used to be the way it was. And I think it probably should go back to the normalcy of it. But on things like the travel ban from certain countries, as you'll recall, I was never a particularly big fan of that in the first place. In terms of its efficacy, my sense when Trump did it was it was sort of a waste of political capital, right? To do that right out of the gate. So even on policy grounds, do I have a big issue with that? No, not terribly. Do I have an issue with the border wall funding? Again, that I would have a policy difference on, because I think border security is important, and I think it's going to be much more important if we're going to have a path to citizenship. I think it's sort of what, you know, the sine qua non to a path to citizenship is you have to secure the border. And this is the argument that people have been having since the 80s, right? I think there are plenty of Republicans who would support a path to citizenship, but first they would say, let's secure the border, because otherwise it just isn't going to work. And there is a caravan on the way from Guatemala right now I'm not making this up. It is, and Biden has said, hey guys, stay where you are until we get this worked out. Now that's exactly my the problem is if we don't have border security and you just open the doors and then say, okay, you're gonna have a path to citizenship, that creates a very bad, and I'm talking like Trump, incentive for illegal border crossing, as opposed to an orderly assimilation and moving people in and getting them, setting them up as citizens. So that's the policy piece of it. On the executive order piece, does he have the authority to do it? I think he does.
Well, I would. I don't know that I disagree with you, but kind of in general, I think the question is, what do we mean by border security? And that there's the rub. I certainly think that we need much expanded border crossing point infrastructure, which has been, I think, very much neglected.
Right.
I think there are a lot of things that are actually
wall, but infrastructure.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of things I think are more effective than walls. And you know, that's been the focus, right? Build a big, yeah, beautiful wall. And I think that's unfortunate, because that sort of symbolic type of thing has made it harder, I think, for a lot of people to really consider, well, what sort of border security, what sort of protocols do we need for a safe and orderly process of people, right, doing things like applying for asylum and being able to enter into the United States in an orderly and legal way? And those are, yeah, important,
amen,
questions.
No, and you and I are, I think you and I are lockstep on that one.
Yeah, yeah. And
although, I mean, I would argue that the infrastructure, to some extent, there has to be some sort of physical barrier in some places, right? I mean, that doesn't mean a border long, 50-foot high, beautiful,
sure,
wall.
Yeah.
But otherwise, I think it's just sort of a fool's errand.
Yeah.
I mean, if you just say, okay, here's the place where you're supposed to report, and folks say, well, I'd just rather not.
Sure. Sure.
You know.
Yeah. And I don't think the Biden administration is going to tear down all the border wall that's there. Right. So, I mean, because, you know, under Democratic and Republican administrations, there have been border wall areas, and I don't see that changing, and for good reason. Right. So I think one thing, though, you know, we're talking about executive orders and seeing that the president has the authority to do these things. I think one thing we will both agree on is that President Biden doesn't actually have the authority to preserve and fortify DACA.
Absolutely, yes.
I mean, we've been talking about this since the end point of the Obama administration, the very beginning of this, you know, when we started this podcast, saying that, hey, maybe we believe, and I believe certainly as a matter of policy, that Dreamers, that kids who came to this country as minors, certainly shouldn't just be summarily tossed out and should have some sort of legal status and path to citizenship. But saying, well, we are going to exercise prosecutorial discretion and not bother prosecuting any of them is essentially ignoring the law, and that's not okay for a president to do. And so,
yeah,
President Obama decided he would push the envelope and do that. And President Biden, not surprisingly, is doing the same thing. But I agree with the intent behind it, but I agree with the Trump administration on this, that actually is goes further than the executive can go. And I expect that when this gets to the Supreme Court, and I think it will, there's a case in Texas right now in I believe district court, I think the Supreme Court will rule that this is actually an unconstitutional exercise of executive authority. And I think that's the right ruling.
Yeah, no, I would agree with you. And the good news is that kicks it back to Congress, which is where the debate,
yeah,
actually ought to take place. And I think there is and has been for years a potential deal out there, where I think there are plenty of Republicans, plenty of conservatives who would support a DACA type path to citizenship program, provided adequate border security.
Yeah, and I think that's going to be the tough thing, because already there's a lot of signals that what President Biden has introduced is just not going to fly in the Senate. And I hope it's just sort of the initial stages of a negotiation and not just that we're not going to do this full stop. And because I think I expect you're on board with the general outlines of that path to citizenship that the proposal outlines, but again, it's a question of, well, and admittedly, the border security part of it is much, while it calls for enhanced border security, it's very fuzzy on that. It's much clearer on the path to citizenship. And I would expect that you and Republicans in the Senate would want something much, much clearer and probably much more than's in the initial proposal.
Yeah, that's correct. I'm not going to speak for the Senate, but I mean, that's certainly my sense of it. And I guess,
yeah,
the issue that, again, gives a lot of conservatives and Republicans pause is when this debate always happens, there is a sense on the right of, hey, we're willing to do a path to citizenship, and yeah, this looks pretty reasonable. But yet there's always opposition on the border security piece, which is troubling. Yeah.
Do you
and
think
it makes us ask, well, why? If this is really the intent, then why not secure the border?
Yeah.
Who wouldn't want to secure the border? Yeah.
Do you think
Chuck
that
Schumer doesn't want to secure the border? That's the answer, but
not at all. Not at all. But do you think that there will be a deal on this? Do you see this as being a something that is a real possibility that there could be legislation on this?
Here's the problem. And I will put on my cynical political hat, which sometimes you like, sometimes you don't, is Democrats hold most, if not all, the cards on this issue. And that is, you know, there was a potential deal back in the Bush administration on this issue. And the guy who tanked it was Senator Barack Obama. There were numerous potential deals throughout the Trump administration. And every time, my sense is that Democrats would much rather have the issue than have a solution. And by doing this, you know, they know they can get it. Republicans can't vote for something that doesn't have some sort of robust border security, and they shouldn't vote for it. And in fact, Bush got pilloried for that late in his administration. So the Democrats have it sort of on both sides. They can beat up Republicans for saying you're mean to the DACA kids, you hate immigrants, you're racist, etc. If any of them sort of move towards conciliation without some kind of border security, they're going to get it from I would say not just their right wing, but I think really from kind of the center of the party. There are a whole lot of Republicans who are just law and order Republicans, right? And they don't have any particular animus against immigrants. In fact, many of them are children, grandchildren of immigrants. But their foreparents came here through whatever the legal processes were, and they expect that everyone else ought to. And I think that's a not insubstantial number of people. So I think it's tough because the Democrats can keep playing this, all the time until if they lost the filibuster or get to 67 votes.
So then your view on this is that this would have been a done deal if only the Democrats would stop playing politics with it and Republicans aren't playing politics with it.
No, I think Republicans obviously are playing politics.
Okay. Because I think you can make the same argument the other way around instead of saying, you hate immigrants, it's, well, you just want open borders. And so I think both sides, to a certain extent, see the value of having this as a live issue. But I think there is
some value, but I think the Democrats hold more cards. And for the reasons I just elucidated.
I don't know.
My question is why wouldn't you want more border security?
Well, I guess it depends on to what extent you're talking about, right? I mean, in terms of obviously the wall type issue, yeah. And I think you're right that there are some people on the left who just reflexively say, well, any border security is bad, and there are some people,
on the left who are openly. Open borders.
Yeah. And just like there are some people on the right who say, you know what, keep America, white. And we don't want those brown people from down south. And so, but they're not representative of a lot of Republicans,
Right. So some of the open border folks, I think, do have a larger say in the halls of Congress, certainly, than you know, these folks who you would describe as nativist.
I don't know. I think there are plenty of, we'll see. I am less optimistic about any sort of a deal happening maybe than you are, but I certainly hope we can.
I wasn't very optimistic at all.
I know. That's what I'm saying. I'm even less optimistic. So, well, tell you what, let's just take one more quick little break. And when we get back, we'll talk about the president's orders on LGBTQ protections, which some on the right are having some real problems with.
Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, I wanted to get into this. I mean, many cultural conservatives were very upset with President Biden's order on LGBTQ protections. And that doesn't actually change existing law in any way, because, of course, it can't. It's an executive order. But it's more of a, I guess I'll characterize it as a broader interpretation of the of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which prohibits discrimination because of sex, and that's the phrase. Now, in Bostock versus Clayton County, Georgia, this was a case the Supreme Court decided in 2019. The court, in a 6-3 decision, held that
Neil Gorsuch writing the majority opinion.
Yeah, and the decision was that an employer who fires someone just because they're gay or transgender does in fact violate Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. Now, the Trump administration said, okay, but that's as far as we're interested in taking it. The Biden administration with this order is signaling pretty strongly that they're taking it further. And this also, Title VII also applies to things like restroom use, locker rooms, right, School sports participation, healthcare, and housing discrimination as well. And as I said, a number of cultural conservatives are pretty upset with that. Jay, you consider yourself, I think, in a lot of ways, a cultural conservative. So, I guess you're probably a bit, you have some
I'm
issue.
Pretty upset about that,
so,
Mike.
Yeah, why don't you explain?
Well, I think looking back, first of all, I mean, I was not a huge fan of the Bostock decision for a number of reasons. We talked about it back then. It's really kind of Gorsuch writing it, but it's still sort of tortured logic to get to where he got on that question. And I think the much better result would be if Congress wanted to amend Title VII, Congress could just amend Title VII. But that ship has sailed. But in Bostock itself, the court still recognized limitations on its own ruling and said, look, we're not making any rulings as to restrooms, accommodations, locker rooms, sports, all that stuff. They spelled it out in the opinion. And when you say the executive order isn't law, well, yes and no. I mean, it's not law yet, but it is sort of a directive to federal agencies that they can seek to enforce this as law. And, you know, it depends on what the courts are going to say. So it opens up a lot of organizations to federal suit, federal, intervention with what they're doing. So I think it's bad from that standpoint, just on the basis of getting the federal government involved in all sorts of local agencies, yep, local governments.
Let me say I agree with you on that first point you made. I think the ideal outcome here would be if Title VII were amended to say because of sex or gender oriented or some, you know, words to that effect.
And
that
Congress can spell it out and have all the definitions and make it much clearer. And it's not just this fuzzy.
Exactly.
Maybe the courts will buy it. Maybe they won't.
And this is a conversation that you and I have a lot. And we invariably agree that legislative action is better than a regulatory agency's interpretation. And so that's
exactly
that. And so I agree with you that while the Biden administration is not changing the law, they're taking a very fuzzy set of words, a very fuzzy phrase, and interpreting it in a broader way, because
and it's proceed at your own risk is the message to all these.
Because if you say, well, here's I think how a lot of folks on the left look at it. If you say, well, this prohibits discrimination because of sex, and if by sex you also mean, for lack of a better, more fitting term, gender orientation, then if that means discrimination in employment, well, then it also should mean discrimination in any other way because of sex. And so the logic is, well, why would you limit that? And I think that gets to your point about the tortured, what you saw as the tortured logic in the decision, right? So why would it be limited? There's no real reason. If you say because of sex really means sex also includes this idea of sort of your gender orientation that again, for lack of a better term here. So yeah, I think that's the correct interpretation given that interpretation. If you say because of sex means also gender and gender, your gender role that you know that you see. And so, but I think it'll be challenged, and I expect that the court will actually overturn some of these things because just for the reasons that you cited, is that the court did in fact say, well, we're limiting this, even though I don't necessarily think that logically follows.
Yeah. Now, so then going to the policy piece of it, again, to me, it's troubling in that I think to a certain extent, when you look at, especially and you're talking about education and kids and there's a lot going on, and there are a lot of other concerns that schools need to address beyond just any certain students' gender identification, right? And I think parents could be rightfully concerned about, hey, is there someone who's a biological male using the same locker room as my daughter? In some cases, I think those concerns are overblown. But I think they're not irrelevant, and this sort of leads to these sort of cultural wars when the left just kind of sneers at, oh, you backwoods oafs, with your again bitterly clinging to these old stereotypes. I think that's an issue. Women's sports, I think, is even a bigger issue, and especially at the collegiate level. Because I will say it at the risk of all the hate that's going to come my way, but men and women are biologically, physically different, and men are on average stronger and faster than women. And I do think it's going to be a real hit to girls' high school sports and more so to women's college sports. Where parents are you going to want your daughter playing against, playing in soccer against someone who's a biological male? Soccer is a tough sport. My kids played for a number of years, and, you know, we had plenty of knockdowns. And so there's that. And there's also the question of will women want to pursue these sports when they know they may face competition from biological men who they will never be able to beat? And that's a fact of life, and it's occurred, I think, in college sports already to some extent. You've had transgender athletes who are biologically male who have broken all kinds of records, as you might expect, And sometimes it's just, I think that's bad for, if our goal is to empower young women through sports, which I think is a great thing to do, this really sets that back.
I agree that these concerns shouldn't be just dismissed out of hand, and that anyone who raises these concerns shouldn't just be labeled as anti-gay or what have you. I think that's absolutely fair, because these seem to be things that need to be considered. But also, I think as you pointed out, that sometimes these concerns can and are overblown for various reasons, right? I mean, there are, I think, at least 16 states that for a while now actually have policies that allow full inclusion of transgender students in high school sports, at least. And that has seemed to have gone off, at least not horrifically. It hasn't been, isn't the phrase I think some people are using, erasing women or something like that. And it's that sort of rhetoric, I think, that makes this more difficult to navigate this issue. And I think there needs to be an acceptance that you can have legitimate concerns. One thing that was raised is, let's say you're a survivor of rape or some other sort of violence, and you can have if you're a woman who survived that, you can have legitimate issues with say having biological males in your restroom. And I think we need to be sensitive to these issues and not just assume that whoever is on the other side of it must just be, either anti-women or anti-gay or something like that.
Right. Yeah, no, the trouble is, I think with this, federal bureaucracies are generally not good with subtlety.
And that's the problem.
In fact, it's sort of their job not to be good at subtlety, right? It's their job is the big hammer into, and that's why I'm not at all enthused about those orders.
And I get that, and that is the problem. And I mean, the order itself is pretty vague. It's just about directing agencies and that sort of thing, but. It is difficult to craft these things, and this is another conversation we've had more than a few times, is in a better world, what would happen is that if there, say, were, and this is just an off-the-top-of-my-head example, if there were, say, a student who, a male student who identifies as female, that student would be able to let the folks at the school know, and they would try to work out some sort of accommodation and so forth. But then there are issues of, well, why should this student have to broadcast, his or her, however that person identifies with whatever pronoun, their identification when others don't. And these are fraught issues, And so you're right that just sort of a one-size-fits-all solution runs the risk of really trampling over legitimate concerns on both sides. And I wish there were good answers to this, and there just aren't. But certainly a good answer to this isn't just saying, well, you know what? Men are men and women are women, and you just need to suck it up. If you have a X, then you need to go to this bathroom. And that's not okay either.
And again, to be clear, that's not really what I'm proposing.
No. I'm not saying you are.
My concern with the executive orders, it would have been easy for President Biden and whoever, wrote up the executive order and the civil rights folks to say, we direct all federal agencies to comply with the Bostock decision.
Yeah, right? Except that they believe
without,
it goes further
without
than that.
The extra, but they're going for the extra, and there's a reason for it, and I think we will see within the next couple of years there are going to be some big suits on this.
Yeah, I'm sure you're right, and I think that their reasoning for that is, I mean, I agree with the logic, I agree with the reasoning, but again, in a better world, that there would be less ambiguity about this, but that still wouldn't change the fundamental nature of the problems that we're talking about, the real world problems, whether or not this is a interpretation of because of sex, or if it were just simply, well, the law were changed to because of sex or gender orientation, you'd still have the same real world problems. It would just, from a legal standpoint, be a clear issue.
Well, you'd also, though, you'd have, if it went through a different again, more democratic channels, there would be the sense of others' voices were heard.
Sure. And that works both ways, right? Because as you said earlier in the show, executive order giveth, the executive order taketh away. Yeah. And so, I think we're definitely in lockstep on that. And then finally, I just want to mention, as I said, the sort of standard, whenever a new administration comes in, they freeze all of the regulations that haven't gone into effect from the previous administration. We expected that. Certainly, that's no big shock. And one other, I guess, thing that I should mention is, in addition to this, I expect that Democrats in Congress will quickly use the Congressional Review Act. And for people who don't know, this allows any regulations that have been promulgated during the last 60 legislative days of the past session of Congress to be rescinded by a simple majority vote. It's not subject to a filibuster.
Right.
And that basically works out to any Trump administration regulations that went into effect after around June 1st of 2020. And also, once a regulation is rescinded through this, no substantially similar regulation can be reintroduced unless it's authorized by law. So that,
right. Not that one would expect.
No,
there would be.
Right, yeah. Right. So, but this is just another mechanism by which, as we see when there's a new administration that disagrees ideologically, and so we're gonna. I'm sure you agree that that's gonna happen, right?
Yeah, that's gonna happen. And then there's game playing that people ought to understand too, and that something that the outgoing administration will do, will issue a lot of orders on policy pieces that they really like and would fire up their base, and then sort of force the other side to vote on it, right? So there's a lot that went on in the Obama to Trump transfer, for example. President Obama declared, half of the West national park, and Trump then rescinded it, and the Democrats, were able to fight back and say, look, he hates parks. There's some of those that are out there, and some of those you'll see. There are two other orders I want to hit on just real quick.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
And one is sort of a policy of significance, and that's the Keystone XL pipeline. The president has now once again rescinded that.
Yes, that's been forever. My gosh, yeah.
His pipeline guy is like, oh, come on, man. And to me, that's troubling in that, listen, the Obama administration approved this five times and came to conclusion that, again, this is the Obama administration, that the actual the pipeline is better for the environment than transporting this oil by either train or truck, and yet here we are. It's going to cost a lot of jobs, union jobs, steel jobs in Ohio, or not Ohio, in Ohio, but throughout the country. And for really what I think most would say is sort of a sop to the environmental left, who just hates fossil fuels under any circumstances. And I think there's a lot of problems also of we can talk all we want about solar, wind, and renewables. But for the time being, we're still operating with fossil fuels, and I'd much rather have a source of that either in the U.S. or real close in Canada than depending on people like the Saudi Arabians. The other piece that I think this is going to be an issue going down the road that we're going to see is, to the extent we push on this solar stuff, a whole lot of the elements, the trace minerals that are needed to make solar equipment are found, just like the oil is in Saudi Arabia, are found in China. And I think that's going to be problematic, and we'll talk about that later. But I think a lot of folks also viewed the Keystone sign-off and the NLRB firing is sort of offsetting, right? To the extent that Biden upset labor with that, he did a makeup with getting rid of the NLRB general counsel. So I think there's something there. The other
Let me just say on the Keystone before you get the other one, that's an order that I certainly approve. I think it's a sign that the Biden administration is going to be to the left of the Obama administration, and I'm okay with that certainly as well. And so I think that it shouldn't have been approved in the first place. I think there's significant negative environmental consequences to it, and so I think that was a very good move, and I was happy to see that. But I just wanted to dip my two cents in on that before you mentioned the other order.
The other order, and this is something we should really do a special show on some point. President Trump had created what was called the 1776 Commission,
yeah,
which was to kind of give a report on the status of the teaching of American history, and somewhat a response to the New York Times 1619 project, which, the basis of that is that America is founded on and because of slavery, and it really takes a views everything in American history through that racial lens. So Trump put together this group. The panel had some folks who are notably conservative. Larry Arn of Hillsdale College, I think, was the chair. But you also had a minority representation. You had folks from various Ivy League schools and Princeton, Stanford. historians who weighed in on this. And they put together a report. And the report, well, you used to be able to get it through the government, but Biden on the first day took it down and disbanded the commission. And that to me is a little bit of a troubling statement, right? Again, if this is we are now all about unity and getting along and sharing our commonalities outweigh our differences. If you read the 1776 report, and I'll send you a copy, and you can still get it at the Heritage Foundation, it comes across as really kind of non-controversial. I don't think there's anything in there that you would say.
Absolutely, plenty of historians would disagree with it. I believe one of the things, just off the top of my head, is one of the big challenges, it said, that of the America's principles in this report, along with slavery and fascism, they mentioned progressivism as a challenge to America's principles. I have a pretty big problem with that. And there are plenty of historians, and there weren't a lot of historians on this panel who point out a lot of problems with logic and reasoning here, and not just that. I want to say just the idea. I would think that as somebody who cares about a state's rights and is concerned about big government trying to tell us what to think, that the idea that there should be some sort of national commission to direct patriotic education, that's creepy to me and very troubling.
Take a look at what the progressives did. I would think the folks who were jailed for passing out pamphlets opposing World War I might disagree that progressivism wasn't in opposition to some fundamental American principles, but like I said, that's why we need to save this for a bigger day.
I pretty strongly feel that the 1776 thing was just a travesty and a horrible idea, and I certainly understand why conservatives may take issue with the 1619 Project, but I think there's a huge difference between a private media organization like, as Donald Trump liked to put it, the failing New York Times puts out its own little series, as opposed to the weight of the federal government behind some sort of national patriotic education thing, which, boy, if that doesn't give you a little shiver of fascism, I don't know what does.
Well, if you ever, again, I'll send you the report and you should read it. I mean, because we should talk about this, because
And you can read the 1619 Project, and we'll talk about it.
Yeah, no, and absolutely. And I will. The idea that, to be clear, I am a little bit put off by the government saying here's what's patriotic and here's what's not. But keep in mind, I think the government has an ability to respond and to criticisms, and to things like the continuing focus that we're having on race and on gender identity politics, right? I think that's something that is really toxic to our system. And I think there is some good, beneficial government purpose in pushing back against it.
And yeah,
have you ever been to Smithsonian American History Museum?
Oh yeah, you know, I have. Yeah.
Of course, the government participates in setting forth statements about its history. If you go to any, any Civil War battlefield, right? I mean, the government, the Park Service is telling you. So I don't see it as fascist as you do to say here's some folks who are giving their outlines about how they think history ought to be taught and sort of a criticism of the current vogue. So
you're right. This really kind of should be its own full segment or show. I think this would be something that's worth doing at greater length. And I'll just say that I understand the argument about identity politics and so forth, but I feel that for hundreds of years, it's white identity politics that's dominated. And I think after just hundreds of years of systemic discrimination, now that it's time to sort of look at a lot of these things. But again, I know this gets us into an entirely different conversation where I think we have some pretty significant disagreements that would be good to, you know, that they are out.
Yeah.
All right. Well, wow, this was an extended show. And, you know, we didn't even get to some really important things, like, for instance, President Trump's pardons. And there was a lot going on with that, as well as, and these are things we're all going to get on the midweek show, by the way, President Trump's pardons, his farewell address, how we see the Trump administration now that it's over, finally, at least from my point of view. And also maybe a little bit about the post-Trump Republican Party. Will there be a Patriot Party? I don't know. But anyway, we're going to be talking about all that stuff on the Midweek Supporter Show. So if you are a supporter, you can expect to see that in your feed on Wednesday. And if you're not, just go to patreon.com/politicsguys to sign up. And as always, if you can't afford to become a supporter and you want that content, just email me at mike@politicsguys.com and I will get you all set up with access to that. And there's also our PayPal, and you can find that out at politicsguys.com/support. And if you just want to get in touch with us for general reasons to comment, criticism, whatever, critique, mail@politicsguys.com. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and you can find the links there in our show notes. Special thanks to our executive producers, Bruce Johnson, Wilma Moreno, Andrea Masker, Daniel Toe, Chris Wilkerson, and Nathan Sosnowski. We'll be back with a new show next week. We hope you join us.